The fact that there is a premium for the price of gold in Shanghai is opening up an arbitrage that ultimately, taken to its extreme, will empty the vaults in New York and London if that premium remains. And just pulling up the data as we're talking, but it has been substantial. It's like $30 an ounce today, down from 40 last week, as high as 90 the week before. $30 to $40 an ounce premium means you could buy, get long in London, stand for delivery, and cover your short in Shanghai and pocket the difference. And the net effect of that is gold leaves London and goes to
Hello and welcome, everybody. Welcome back to Soar Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here because we're today diving into the world of geopolitics, oil, gold, and lots more. Lots happening in the world. And I'm so excited to have the number one finance writer on Substack back here on the channel. It is Doomberg. I think I said it before in the last interview as well. I'm always nervous when he comes on because I completely feel outbrained and outsmarted here in this conversation. And I always learn so much when I chat with him. I hope it is the same for you. If you are learning a lot, please leave a comment, leave a like as well, because we're doing this for you. It's really, really important to be educated, especially in this market. There's so much going on, especially with that bubble forming in the S&P 500 right now, in my opinion. So stay informed, follow channels like ours, and get educated. Now, without further ado, let me bring Doomberg on the screen. Doomberg, it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Kai, you're too kind. It's great to be back. Always enjoy our conversations, and it is certainly a two-way street. Looking forward to another fantastic one today.
Fantastic. No, I really appreciate it. And let's dive right in because we do have a lot to discuss. Last time you were on was October 10th, or right around the attack on Israel back then. And a lot has changed since then. And I'm trying to find a good summary question where we could start off of. But I think geopolitics is the jumping off point here for the discussion. And I'd like to throw in the commodities here. Like how much are geopolitics weighing on commodity prices right now? Maybe that's a good starting off point.
Yeah, I think the price of oil is obviously the logical place to start. And I think despite the fact that other commodities are selling at substantial discounts to prices we saw just 2 years ago, oil has kept a relatively decent bid under it. Last I checked, we were in the high 70s to low 80s, WTI and Brent. And I think there's certainly a geopolitical risk premium priced into oil these days, although it's an interesting question, because if the market truly thought that a kinetic war between the US and Iran were on the horizon, I suspect the price of oil would be much higher than it is today. So I think the market is pricing in some risk, but the base case is that eventually things in Israel will get resolved. Keeping a far closer eye on the evolving situation in Russia / Ukraine, I think the Western media has done a disservice to its audience in the way in which it has covered that situation. I think the situation on the ground there is a little more desperate than until very recently has been portrayed. And that too will have a pretty significant impact on the commodity markets. If we take a step back, I think, you know, the world is long energy today after a crisis, and most commodities, their prices are sort of very, very low levels, with the exception of oil. And I do think that sort of drives back to the Middle East. So that's my opening thought on the situation.
No, I appreciate that, Doomberg. And you mentioned it, like the oil price at the beginning here. I'm of the opinion it should be way higher right now. And I'm surprised it is not being priced higher, especially with the tensions, as you said, in the Middle East, especially around the Red Sea, longer shipping routes, things like that. Why is it only $78 a barrel right now? Like, I think maybe you can help me understand it
sure.
A little bit.
Let me give you a counter. In the US today, natural gas is trading for the energy equivalent price of $10 a barrel oil. And LNG, you know, imports into Europe are selling for the oil equivalent price of $45 a barrel. Coal is back to very, very reasonable levels. And at their core, these primary energy inputs have a sufficient degree of fungibility that, you know, deeply depressed prices in natural gas kind of put a lid on the price of oil. And I would argue, given where the other primary energy inputs are trading today, oil is relatively elevated. And if we did not have the war in Israel, if October 7th had not happened, I suspect oil would be trading with a five handle, given the deluge of supply coming out of the U.S. shale patch, for example. And so I think, you know, the market is never wrong. You just try to understand what the market is trying to teach you, right? That's sort of our philosophy when we look at the prices on our screen. I think if you plot them on an energy content basis, oil stands out for good reason. We have disruption in the shipping lanes of the Middle East. But with natural gas at $1.80 in the US and $8 per million BTU delivered LNG to Europe, with coal, you know, I forget where it is, at low 100s, oil should be trading in the $40 to $50 range. Mm-hmm. And so I think the risk premium of geopolitics is there. I think if a full war broke out, I think it would be trading much higher. And I just think the market is discounting the possibility of that. And maybe getting that wrong, but or you may think that the probability is higher than the market is currently pricing. But that's the way we would look at the price of oil today.
Now, with that reasoning, I hope the market is right, to be honest. So let's stick with that. You mentioned natural gas, and I've seen you've put out a number of articles on natural gas. I also saw that it just broke below the break-even point for many producers as well, which is $2. Curie, can you break that down for us a little bit as well? Like, I'm trying to understand the price moves behind natural gas. Is it just because of the seasonality or an extremely warm winter, I mean by that? Or what's driving prices lower right now in natural gas?
All of the above. So you have a very warm February, the chart that we put in our last piece, which frankly, we admitted that we got a few things wrong in our assessment of the natural gas market. The heating degree days, which is the measure of basically a proxy that the market uses for how much natural gas will be used in home heating, which is the dominant use in the winter, at least in the U.S., shows against the five-year averages that we are an extremely, extremely mild winter. And this is reflected in the U.S. weekly natural gas storage report, which is coming out in about 20 minutes, which I'm very curious to see. But last week's report showed that U.S. natural gas storage levels were an incredible 22% higher than the five-year average. And this is in the face of record production, of course. So, and much of the production in the U.S., particularly in the Permian, is associated gas or it's a byproduct. And so the primary driver for drilling of natural gas in the Permian is because you're drilling for oil and you get natural gas, right? And so perversely, the geopolitical risk premium we just talked about is working to keep a lid on natural gas prices in the U.S. because they're drilling for oil with it selling in the high 70s. Who cares what you get for your natural gas, right? In fact, prices in the Permian have gone negative several times in the past. And so we are beginning to see curtailments. So like Marcellus is more direct drilling for natural gas, and they account for 30% of U.S. gas production. I was perusing the fourth quarter earnings calls of the major players in the Marcellus Shale, like, you know, obviously EQT and Range Resources and so on. And we're beginning to see talk of curtailment, but the industry is hesitant to do that. And and everybody's waiting for the weather to turn and for prices to rise again. And so it's kind of a game of chicken right now, whether enough supply will be taken offline or whether, you know, the Permian production rolls over, as some people are fearing it might. We shall see. But at $1.80, it's just really a remarkable thing that a million BTUs of natural gas is clean burning fuel that can be used in your kitchen. It can be burned in your furnace. It can be used to make fertilizer. It's an input into all manner of cogeneration facilities that power much of the manufacturing sector in the U.S. You can get a million BTUs of natural gas today for the cost of a small fry at McDonald's. It just shows you, like, just how powerful the technology is. Even what you just said, the break-even price for these people is $2 per million BTU. That's the result of technology, right? I mean, the perfection of the engineering to extract these resources is mind-boggling and perennially underestimated by market players. But I think, perversely, as I said, this geopolitical risk premium that's keeping oil elevated is in a backdoor way adding supply pressure to what is basically stranded natural gas in the U.S. Now, this will resolve. Inevitably, we will reach a bottom and prices will recover and markets will clear and a shortage will appear and prices will spike. This is forever thus in the commodity sector. So I'm not saying that the situation is permanent, but, you know, we called we were, you know, a little early on the first energy crisis, probably stayed with it too long. And then I think we made a pretty good call in November when we talked about the glut that's forming in natural gas, both LNG and also domestically in the US. How long we stay in this situation, of course, remains to be seen and depends on the behavior of the players involved. But this coupling of production for expensive oil and cheap natural gas is a real issue in the US.
How is that affecting households? Natural gas, a lot of people have gas stoves, as you mentioned, in the US. How is that affecting households? Because we got PCE numbers today, and I'm seeing, like, I just read the headlines more or less. I didn't dive into the details, but I saw that spending was up by the consumers. So I'm trying to figure out if they have more money available and where that is coming from.
I think they do. I mean, this is something that we've talked about at length, both in several of our pieces and on various podcasts. You know, we all know that if oil goes to $200 a barrel, a recession swiftly follows. And we all know that because Germany screwed up its energy policy, the country is deindustrializing and it's in a recession. Same thing with the UK. We have an abundance of cheap hydrocarbons in the US. Why wouldn't that be bullish for economic development and activity? We're seeing a boom in manufacturing construction, which will inevitably lead to a boom in manufacturing hiring. This comes at a time where the US national security state is interested in onshoring and friendshoring away from China. And you're just awash in hydrocarbons. The U.S. has added 2.5 Saudi Arabias of primary energy production just because of the shale patch. And you're plugging this into forward integrated manufacturing sector. Unlike other petrol states, the U.S. actually has meaningful manufacturing that can take advantage of such cheap inputs. So it doesn't surprise me that GDP is coming in high enough to avoid a recession, that consumers are feeling a little bit of extra spend in the wallet. You know, when gasoline at the pump is cheap, we all think that's good for the consumer. Why wouldn't, you know, incredibly cheap electricity and home heating bills also be beneficial to the consumer? I think it makes sense. And also, I think it explains why the market keeps underestimating Jerome Powell. I think we will be higher for longer. We too underestimated Powell in the beginning. We also thought going from 0 to 5 would cause a recession. And we thought production of energy in the US would roll over. We were wrong on those counts. And so we connected the dots and said, here's why we're wrong. The US continues to produce an enormous amount of energy and the economy is going to be strong. Now these things will change. Again, the cure for low prices is low prices. And so this is not a permanent state. It's just the is state of today.
Question that popped into my head, and I hope it's a relevant one, is like, how deflationary or inflationary is the current price environment? That's the question. That is deflationary versus inflationary. I just mentioned that the consumer is spending more money. Does that, how does that translate? Right? Are the natural gas prices more deflationary or inflationary? Like, depends, I guess, two sides of the coin, I guess.
Deflationary, I think, clearly. I mean, the reason why we worry about high energy prices is because they're inflationary and they ultimately trigger a recession. And so, I mean, I think the reverse has to be true.
Yeah, no, makes sense. It was just a question that popped into my head, because if the consumer has more money, with that, which one is more powerful, right? So,
I think it ultimately, low energy prices and abundant energy resources are undeniably bullish for an economy that is prepared to accept them. The dangers of a petrostate and so on are real. But it's a whole other thing we could go down. But I think, you know, if you're a petrostate, the first thing you should do is dollarize your economy, because then you'll avoid the hyperinflationary spiral that struck Venezuela. But that's a topic for another day.
And then you buy gold and you're safe. But yes. we'll talk about that next time. But you brought up the recession topic. I think it's an important one. And I've asked that other guests on the program as well. Like, you mentioned that we might have underestimated Jerome Powell, because everybody's been sort of poo-pooing on him. It's like, oh, the Fed is always doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. Just looking at the last 18 months here, they made some forecasts, like, inflation is transitory. Yes, it's not down to 2%, but if I look at the inflation chart, it looks like it came back down. Different factors weighing on it now. Rate hikes seem to have been absorbed by the market somewhat. We haven't seen that big crash. Commercial real estate, yes, they're dense, and maybe small cracks forming, but nothing's broken yet. Like, if you were to give the Jerome Powell and the Fed a school grade right now, Doomberg, what would it be?
Well, I would start by saying that it is an impossible job, and I don't understand why people would want it. I think Jerome Powell, too early to tell, but probably deserves some credit. I think the balance sheet is shrinking, interest rates are high, inflation is coming down, and the economy hasn't crashed. Now, Did Jerome Powell have anything to do with the energy revolution in the shale patch? No. Did Joe Biden have anything to do with the energy revolution in the shale patch? Not only no, but actively worked against it, but still gets to benefit from it. So the benefit of incumbency is you're accountable for bad results, but you get to take credit for good results. I think an unbiased assessment of where we are today would have to say that in solving the problem that they created themselves, they've done a better than expected job. How's that for a grid? I don't think we're out of the woods. I think commercial real estate is a real challenge. I do think they'll paper it over through the election. I do think Jerome Powell is a raw political actor. I don't think you can ascend to the throne of Fed chair being a politically agnostic individual. And so our base case is no recession until the election. But all bets are off if we do see a crisis. These things are hard to control. Economies are hard to curtail. But I think on balance, if you would have told us a year ago that we would have gone from zero to five and the balance sheet would shrink at the rate at which it's shrinking and that the economy would be producing relatively stable, good growth GDP prints, employment numbers, you know, whatever your view of the government's methodologies coming in relatively strong, we would have been surprised. And so credit where credit is due. He's pulled off more than most people thought he could in a shorter period of time than many thought possible.
Okay. Now, what camp are you in, Doomberg? Are you more in the May camp or let's cut later? Like, I'm curious where you lay your eggs.
Well, I think we need to fight inflation. I think inflation is insidious. I think, and so I would say that also I think real interest rates are positive. I'm in the Jim Grant school of letting the market put a fair price on interest. The cost of money shouldn't be micromanaged or centrally planned. So at the highest level, to the extent that we can allow a clearing price for interest rates to be found by the market, in the long run, we'll be better off. The problem, of course, is our political cycles are in very short runs. And so we're playing this generational game of kick the can down the road to the point of triggering a crisis. I think that the U.S. fiscal situation is unsustainable. And so, but the single most important job of the Federal Reserve, assuming that a country needs a Federal Reserve, which is a different discussion altogether, is to maintain a lid on inflation. And so if we have to keep interest rates higher for longer, until something breaks, et cetera, then I think the more the market could absorb, as you properly articulated, it'll absorb these hikes and put a lid on inflation, the better. Inflation is very, 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 very dangerous phenomenon and attacks the soul of society. It robs savers and it's really a regressive tax on the most challenged economically amongst us. And any proper reading of history knows that we are far too flippant right now about just printing away our problems, about running these huge fiscal deficits, about $1 billion, you know, $1 trillion interest payments a year. I mean, it's a tough challenge. And again, this is a challenge of our own making. So it's not like these problems just immaculately appeared. This is decades. You know, you could pin the blame on Greenspan if you want to go back far enough. That's when the Fed put really saturated the market and led to this mania of speculation and so on that we, you know, these waves of speculative manias that we seem to be forever encountering in the markets. This is not the stuff of well-run, generationally responsible governance.
No, absolutely not. Not the last few years in particular. So that's really put a different spin on things. It's really tough to compare it with history as well, what we've seen, just the creation of free money in general. We need to talk about recession there, Doomberg, and what could trigger it. I brought up commercial real estate, and I'm curious if you're looking at any other indicators, leading economic indicators, general indicators, for that to happen. And why are you so confident saying it won't be until the election? Is it really that political?
No, I just think that you have this pulse of cheap energy. So we are an energy first team, of course. And so, every nail looks like an energy nail when we're holding the hammer that we have. But I just don't think that you can have the world's cheapest source of hugely abundant hydrocarbons plugged into a relatively sophisticated manufacturing sector, combined with a vibrant venture capital startup world, AI, whatever you think of that bubble, that's a US-focused technology, data centers. The US has a lot going for it. We are, in many ways, a broken country. I'm not here to minimize and to say that everything is great. We've accomplished amazing things with a hand and a half tied behind our back, right? The amount of energy that we produce and our ability to add value to that energy is unparalleled in the world. And so if energy rolls over, all bets are off. When energy rolls over, because it always does. But for now, with natural gas so cheap that we can't give it away, it's hard to see. What could happen? We could see a collapse in commercial real estate. And I do think the banks are playing a bit of a cute game of extend and pretend. But at the same time, of all the problems that a politicized Fed could handle and stem a crisis in, you would think it would be basically a banking crisis driven by bad loans. The Fed knows how to handle such things. And they have shown that they're willing to break the law to stop such crises from metastasizing to full-blown cancer. And especially since we only have 9 months to go before the election. Is that really all that long a period of time for the Fed to exercise its awesome powers, its unconstitutional powers? So it's just being realistic, Kai. These are the pieces on the board. And I think, yes, there's lots of things to worry about in commercial real estate. Yes, many of our trading partners are slipping towards a recession, Europe, for example. Who knows what's going on in China? I suppose that's, a rapid devolution of economic activity in China is a potential catalyst for a recession here and would explain why we might fall into one, even though we don't think we will. We're prepared to be wrong. It's okay to be wrong. The only thing worse than being wrong in this business is not having a view and showing your homework as the basis of that view. Other people have different views. We respect those views. We learn from them, and we're not afraid to pivot if we think we got something wrong. I've been to Saudi Arabia, right? The sidewalks are paved with gold. Having 2.5 Saudi Arabias plugged into your manufacturing sector in a period of 15 years is bullish. And it just is.
I have one last question, just for that topic, and it's the extremely cheap energy prices make the U.S. hyper-competitive versus the rest of the world, in particular against the EU. You mentioned that earlier, that Germany is in a recession because of the high energy cost, and it was always the country with the lowest power and energy cost that was prevailing economically as well. Do you even see a case where we have a trampoline economy where everything is just honky-dory even after the elections?
Sure. That's kind of our base case. I mean, now, we have huge headwinds of utterly corrupt, out of control DC establishment, a uniparty orgy of corruption, a feeding on the public trough, the likes of which is a total affront to any right-thinking people. It's amazing to us the flippant nature with which, for example, we just imagine we should start a war everywhere around the world. But to hear Lindsey Graham talking about how we should be carpet bombing Iranian refineries, as though there would be no rebound effect to us. You know, the amount of waste and mismanagement in DC is a staggering anchor around the necks of entrepreneurs, the regulatory state. All of these things are huge challenges. So in the flows of what's bullish and what's bearish, it's not just that energy is great, so everything is great. There are huge challenges to the country. I, for example, we are deeply concerned that half the country will not accept the result of the next election, regardless of who wins. That's pretty negative for social cohesion and economic activity. That's a big risk. Assuming we can work these things out, assuming saner heads prevail, assuming this current batch of senile politicians eventually gets wiped away, because that's what they are. It's amazing to me that we put up with this as a country. So I'm not here to say everything is great. I'm here to say the reason everything is not as bad as it could be is because we have this energy miracle, and it buys us time to get things right.
No, I appreciate that. Thanks for the clarity on that. And I wholeheartedly agree on pretty much all the points you made there as well. And that's me, the German, looking into the US and just observing, right? So really, really interesting comments there. Dumer, switching gears just a little bit, we talked about it briefly, and we talked about it at length, actually, though our last interview was talking about the sanctions against Russia. A topic that's popped up just recently again is the freezing and seizing of Russian assets, $300 billion in total. There's a big rat tail attached to that. And there's a discussion of spending that money right now on and giving it to the Ukraine, for example, for reparations already. The question is the signal that sends. I think that's the big rat tail we need to talk about there, Dumberg. What signal does it send if the US and the EU, which apparently holds like 2/3 of the reserves, of Russian reserves, starts spending money it doesn't own?
Yeah, I think this would be a catastrophic blunder of historic proportions. And I think the US and the UK have been agitating for it. And to the credit of the Europeans, they have been hesitant to do this because they understand the consequences of it. The majority of these reserves, as you mentioned, are held in the European banking system. Whatever you think of Putin, I happen to think that he made a huge mistake going to war. I think the tactics they're using are inhumane. I've done a deep dive on the sort of military situation for my own curiosity, probably not something we would write about. And to see the complete leveling of villages and towns, carpet bombing and then storming, the utter destruction of a country, the meat grinder that the war has become, the responsibility for this lies at the feet of Putin. Did the West do things to put us in a position where a person like him would act in this way? Perhaps. Is there things that we could have done better? Certainly. War is always the last resort, and I think it's really just a sad commentary on the state of the full suite of leaders in the world that were in this state. But having said all of that, the words can't describe how big of a blunder it would be to steal $300 billion of another country's reserves. There's no legal justification for it that I can find. I'm not a lawyer. But the consequences, the second and third order effects of such a move, I think would be pretty challenging. And that's the thing that I find amazing about our sanctions policy in general. And to an extension of that, our energy policy. We seem incapable of looking past the first dimension and into the second and third order effects of a decision. Yes, Putin is a bad man. Taking the reserves of Russia would send a very powerful signal to leaders across the world who have a very different view of Putin than we do, it must be said, and who have a very, very different view of the lead up to and causes of this war, and will vote with their feet at a time where the US is running huge fiscal deficits and needs to refinance an enormous amount of debt because of Yellen's desire to issue short-term debt, and all of that debt now needs to be refinanced at much higher rates. Where's that bid going to come from? If you're Saudi Arabia, if you're Brazil, if you're India, sure, you're not in the crosshairs today, but you could be. Why would you take the chance? Now, actually, I fear that just the talk of it has done a fair bit of damage. We've threatened it. People have agitated for it. That puts it on the table. That means people think it's possible. Whether or not we do it is almost irrelevant now. I think the damage is done. So we are going to see the second and third order consequences here. Like, again, my views on Putin, my views on the war, they're not relevant. What matters is the views of the marginal buyer of U.S. treasuries. And that isn't me. That's, you know, the developing world. That's, you know, that's wealthy people who are seeing how we treated the quote-unquote oligarchs and wondering whether they should take their money out of the Western banking system. Ultimately, all banking systems are confidence games, right? And the Western banking system is no different. And so I just think I cringe when I hear Lindsey Graham talk about bombing Iran, and I cringe when I hear Lord Cameron talking about seizing Russian reserves, and I cringe when I hear people saying we can quit fossil fuels. Like, it's all the same disease of ignorance. They're just the very symptoms of it. I mean, one of the reasons why I've started to take a dive into the military situation in Ukraine is because it's the same architects of our energy policy and our sanctions policy that are ultimately leading our military strategy. You know, the military is only as good as its leaders, right? And so why would it be any different there? I don't know military, so I just assume there must be some competence over there, right? But I know energy, and I feel like we've made a pretty good call on sanctions. And so then it occurred to me, like, why would it be any different? And I, from what I've learned, I don't think it is. I think things are going badly over there.
Well, running out of ammunition, just for one, just it seems like a whole basket case right now.
Well, I'm curious how it's being reported in Germany. I mean, you know, I saw Scholz was out saying they weren't going to send weapons, and all but admitted that the British were there. I don't know if that's getting big story in Germany today, but it's really amazing.
No, like, it feels like reporting has died down. I wouldn't say completely. There's still articles, but it's a lot quieter. It's more about a three-year-old kid being run over in Germany that fled from the Ukraine that got run over by two cars the same day. That's where the media's attention is right now. It's not on where you mentioned is like the turmoil, and it's getting worse there, and Putin's actually advancing. Again, there are a few articles, but you have to look for them.
So. Well, it's the same here. I mean, I'm surprised they're still allowed to be on YouTube, but there's all manner of open source information that you can find, and you have to understand that some of it is Russia biased and some of it is Ukraine biased. But, you know, as a free-thinking person, you hope that you can work your way through those biases in an effort to learn something. But, yeah, the media is not portraying what's actually going on over there until very, very recently. I think the fall of Avdiivka, it was a real watershed moment. And that's why we're seeing this panic. I think that the reach for the $300 billion flows from the fact that the political support for the war in the U.S. is eroding. They're blaming it on the big, bad orange man, but I think support had begun to erode. Donald Trump is many things. I think he's just a political follower. Like, he reads the room and he goes with it. And so I think, you know, his recent opposition to funding in Ukraine is politically opportunistic. And look, Biden's in charge. And if the war goes bad on his watch, it's going to hurt his election chances. So it's a very complex situation for sure.
Absolutely. I'm just puzzled that we haven't learned anything from the SWIFT debacle and weaponizing the SWIFT system, and we're trying to make that same mistake. It's just even bigger gravity.
Well, so, I mean, we've been like 3 weeks into the sanctions. We wrote a piece called Crazy Pills that was was pretty prescient. And we've written three or four times since then, like Whack-A-Mole was our most recent. We just assume that we have more power than we do. Like, the craziest thing is to assume that Western insurance policies is a powerful enough weapon to stop the flow of oil out of Russia. I don't know where these people were educated on the commodities markets. It staggers me.
It's puzzling because it's all in India right now, and it's coming into Germany. So,
well, it's coming into the U.S. and we import Indian diesel that is refined Russian crude. It's so crazy.
We don't need to go down that rabbit hole there, Doomberg. But it is crazy. Like, it wasn't thought through. I have one last topic, or it's back to commodities here, and pretty much to my opening question about geopolitics weighing on prices of things, commodities in particular. I quickly want to talk about the gold price. I know we haven't done that in the past, but I've seen an article you've written, so I figured I'd touch on that, because we've been hovering over the $2,000 level for quite a while now. And the question, again, pretty much similar question as the opening question, is how geopolitical is the gold price right now, and what's keeping it where it is?
Well, it ties a lot of things we've talked about here today. I think there are two main sort of obsessions, I would say, or areas of interest amongst gold enthusiasts that look set to be resolved in 2024, which is what we wrote about in a piece called Golden Resolution. One is, if they do reach for these sanctions, I think gold inevitably will reassert its place as a neutral reserve asset for the settling of trade imbalances. And I think you'll see a scramble for gold amongst the ongoing scramble for gold, an accelerated scramble for gold by the central banks around the world, especially those that are concerned about someday finding themselves in the crosshairs of the American and European elite. The second, of course, is this long suspected belief that the paper price of gold is being suppressed by the Western banks at the behest of presumably the BIS and other central banks in the West. The opening of the Shanghai Gold Exchange, something Luke Groman has chronicled for years. I think he's been pretty prescient on this. Luke Groman over at Force for the Trees, I always like to give credit for where I learn things. The fact that there is a premium for the price of gold in Shanghai is opening up an arbitrage that ultimately taken to its extreme, will empty the vaults in New York and London if that premium remains. And just pulling up the data as we're talking, but it has been substantial. It was it's like $30 an ounce today, down from 40 last week, as high as 90 the week before. $30 to $40 an ounce premium means you could buy, get long in London, stand for delivery, and cover your short in Shanghai and pocket the difference. And the net effect of that is gold leaves London and goes to Shanghai. And if the Chinese are doing this ahead of gold's reemergence as a neutral reserve asset for the settlement of trade imbalances, then that's a pretty shrewd move on the part of the Chinese. And it might be happening right under our nose. And there's only so much gold. So eventually, if the price is in fact being suppressed, and I've, to be very clear, not saying it is, I'm saying many people believe it is, that bluff is going to be called by the Chinese this year. And eventually, if the price is being suppressed, the relief valve has to be opened and prices will have to converge to stop the flow of gold from the West to the East. And so both of these things look set to resolve this year. We'll see. I'm bullish gold because I like gold. It's a savings vehicle for us. It's not an investment. And I've often said, if we wake up tomorrow and gold is not 2050, but 5050, that's probably bad news for the rest of your portfolio. It's probably bad news for the country. Something big has happened. And yes, you have been partially insulated against it, but that's testament. That's tantamount to being happy when your house burns down because you had insurance. Like, you know, this is not the way we think about it, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah, absolutely. If gold hits $5,500, you can't step outside anymore, at least the way I'm thinking about it. So it's a crazy world out there, Dunberg. So much going on. Really, really appreciate you putting a lot of perspective around many things for us, clarifying like the oil and gas market for me is, again, like is not my forte. That's why I love talking to you every time we catch up every 3 to 4 months, because I learn new things and I get a better understanding of what is actually happening. So really appreciate it. You have your domain below your title, but where can we follow you? Because you're off X now.
Yeah, we're exclusively on Substack. Everything we do can be found at doomberg.substack.com. Substack has Notes, which is a variant of Twitter where we're active. All of our pieces are there. Our pro tier presentations are available for our premium subscribers as well. And then every podcast appearance we do, we chronicle on that website as well under the Doomcast tab. It's really been great to talk to you, Kai. It's always fun to have wide-ranging discussions with people who have an open mind and are just interested to learn like we are. And by the way, lots of things we said today will look foolish in 6 months. If you're not willing to look foolish, this is not the business for you. We have views on things and we have an open mind and we have a mindset of continuous improvement. And that's how we plan to persist in this business for decades to come.
Fantastic. No, thank you so much, Dunberg. It's really, really insightful. Love following your work and always appreciative when you come on.
Same with you, Kai. Loved it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. Please leave a like, leave a comment if you like this conversation. If you learned something, leave a like. I've definitely learned something from Dunberg every time he comes on. Really appreciative of his time, of course. Make sure to check him out on Substack. They're the number one finance blog on Substack for a reason. You just heard it for 30 minutes. He was so fantastic. Absolutely. Make sure to leave a subscribe here as well. Follow the channel. Really appreciate you tuning in. We'll be back with lots more to educate you on the macro to understand the micro. Thank you so much. We'll be back with more.